Our first speaker will be Jarrett Quakoda. Jarrett is XBRL Services Leader at Ernst & Young. And our second speaker, and I apologize because we neglected to put her name up here, but she's sort of our mystery speaker, is Donna Johanneman. Donna is XBRL Project Manager at the FASB. Third speaker will be Amy Beers, Senior Technical Manager, Business Reporting, Assurance and Advisory Services, and XBRL at the AICPA. And then myself, Michelle Savage, VP for Communication at XBRL US. So with that, I want to first slide and turn it over to Jarrett Quakoda. Jarrett, are you ready to present?
Oh, sorry about that. Looks like I was muted for a little bit. So I'd like to thank everybody for attending this webcast. The areas that I'm going to cover is a number of different data quality issues that are identified, you know, for some that can be identified just may use software to assist, and others you cannot use software and you have to actually manually look for different quality errors. So a lot of as you can see, this is a number of data quality errors that are identified by the XBRL US Consistency Suite. So you can see that, you know, there's a lot of different types of errors that come up, and there's some prevalent ones that are around invalid members, non-negative, so entering an amount as a positive, never negative correctly, which has been a big issue. You know, throughout that the SEC has actually commented on their observations as well. Companies not having required tags that they're supposed to, which I'll hit on, having incorrect dates, and then also some various other ones, including roll forwards and calculations. So I'm going to cover some of the common ones that we're seeing a lot, you know, that are identified by the software. And so the first one is invalid member combinations along with axes. So what I wanted to point out is when you have members or dimensions, you're always going to have an axes and a domain, which the axes is basically a bucket for your members. I know I see a lot of my clients that I help out, you know, they definitely pay attention to the line item tags. And some will focus on members as well. But some companies may not be aware that there's axes tags, and those axes tags have definitions. So if you have a member, that member needs to be appropriate under that specific axes. So here's an example where if you have a axes that is for, you know, if you're breaking out revenue by country, so your axes would be different, you know, countries or geographic regions. As you see here, you know, US and Japan make sense for these. So you would have that, you know, axes and member combination. But to the right, you can see if you're disclosing fair value of something as well, you wouldn't want to put that fair value member underneath the axes for countries or geographic areas, because that would, you know, the definition of the axes would be geographic country. And, you know, I know that sounds pretty simple and easy, but a lot of the times companies may not be focusing on the axes and members and just focusing on the tags itself, and you'll see a lot of errors or inappropriate matching of the member tags and the axes tags. Another area that I'd like to point out would be is another example where having an invalid member underneath the domain. And here's something common I see. If you're disclosing something for your debt disclosure, and sometimes you're breaking out information by specific debt instrument, as you see down below, you can see a lot of, you know, notes 3.875, notes due in 2016. So those are specific debt instruments, and that would make sense to go underneath the debt instrument name and debt instrument axis. But if you look above, looks like they were using a senior subordinated notes member. Now, that's a very specific standard member for this, and that would be a debt type, not a specific debt instrument name. So it's important to, you know, make sure that when you're looking at the axes and you're using different members, that, you know, it may be, you may have to use a different axis. In this case, it would be debt type if you want to use senior subordinated notes, and some of these axes would, you know, require you to extend members at all times. And this is the debt instrument name would be one of those where I'd expect to always see an extension tag for those and not using standard members for types.
And
Michelle, it looks like my next slide is no longer, I can no longer see that. There we go. Thank you. Next area that is prevalent in the errors, especially in the, you can see in the consistency suite stats, is, you know, non-negative. Amounts in XBRL that are entered as a negative and should be positive. So XBRL is designed for a majority of the time for tags to be entered as a positive. And there's only specific tags that should be entered as a negative, you know, depending on if it's appropriate. And there's a lot of tags that are one-sided, meaning that they should always be positive in most circumstances. So here's a number of examples. We have assets, common stock, additional paid in capital, interest expense. We wouldn't expect these type of tags to be entered as negative because, you know, for some, for obvious reasons, there's really no such thing as a negative asset or negative common stock. So you really need to focus on what's the definition encompassing, and, you know, is this tag, like, for interest expense, that's very specific just to the interest expense. So it wouldn't represent interest income. So if you were to have interest income and expense in the same row, you want to make sure that you're using a two-sided tag that basically can encompass both expenses and income if you have that situation. This is actually a big problem that we have where we're companies follow entering the amount as a negative just because on the HTML or source documents, they have brackets or a negative value in front of it. And, you know, as we're going to go through, it's appropriate to enter in amount just because it's got brackets. You actually want to look at the tag, look at the tag type, or the balance type, which is a credit or debit. Conceptually understand, is your concept of credit or debit, and then enter it as a negative if it's the opposite, if that is not a one-sided tag. So I'm going to go into some more details around this area. So here's some examples that the SEC put out of, you know, definitions or language that can be negative. So there's a lot of cash flow where you have increase, decrease, or something that says net, payments from, gain or loss, you know, income, expense, and so on. So these are the types of things that you'd say, okay, yes, this can be positive or negative, and then based on your situation, you can make that decision. Make sure that you're considering the balance type of the tag that you're using. Is the balance type a debit or credit? In your HTML or your source document, what is the natural accounting balance of that? Is it a debit or credit? And if it's not a one-sided tag, if the tag is a debit and natural value is a credit, you would enter as a negative. And that would be the opposite. If your tag, you know, the tag is a credit and, it, and your concept is a debit, then you enter as a negative. And as I mentioned before, make sure you focus on the definition. The definition is very important in that determination if something can be a one-sided tag or, you know, possibly being entered as a negative or positive. And there, you know, this was addressed, as I mentioned, by the SEC in their observations. And the AICPA also has a document that they published that goes through some best practices in addressing and assessing amounts being entered as a negative or positive as well. That can be very helpful to you. I just want to put this as an example where you have on the statement of shareholder equity. Here's where you the first row is the beginning balance of equity. In this case, you would likely use one tag, which is, you know, your shareholders' equity beginning balance tag. If you look all the way to the right, there's actually a column for treasury. So if you're going to use shareholders' equity tag, and this treasury balance is actually decreasing that, this would be one of those examples where you would enter the amount as a negative because that would be appropriate. We just want to point that out that sometimes with the modeling and you're using the same tag going across, if you have an amount that's decreasing that balance, it would be appropriate to enter it as a negative. So here's just some general rules to go by. You know, basically from inputting something as a positive or negative, looking at it from an absolute perspective, well, from in an accounting system, look at it as, are these debits or are these credits? And are the tags that we are picking, or do they represent debits or credits? Don't think of it as a positive or negative perspective, just looking at your paper financial statements. You know, depending on how you present the data, maybe differently than what the tag is actually representing. So you have to make sure that they're consistent with each other. And make sure that you're focusing on definitions, since the definitions dictate how you should enter something as a positive or negative value. So one example where it says tax benefit associated with equity-based compensation plans. It doesn't say tax benefit expense. So therefore, this would only be for tax benefit. So I've seen, you know, companies where they have both benefits and expenses, you know, using tag. You wouldn't want to enter this as a negative because in this case, it isn't a negative benefit. It's actually an expense. So you'd probably want to use a different tag for that instance. Another area in that is, you know, very important, and these are agricultural sections, is that there's certain required information that has to be in your XBRL document. So here's one example. It's your document identity information, and this is in the XBRL rule from the SEC. And as you can see, for different filings, where the X's are, you are required at a minimum to tag each one of these respective tags based on the X for these specific files. So if you're filing a, you know, 10Q or 10K and you're missing one of those, then you'd be in violation of the rule for that. So just pay particular attention that, you know, there are at a minimum specific tags that you have to include in your file. And you want to make sure that you're not going to rule for something, you know, as simple as, you know, entering a CIK number or something like that. So the next area that I'm hitting on is, you know, and I tend to see this quite often for companies, is especially your stockholders' equity. At times where you have either blanks or dashes in your statement, where you would not tag something, and or those should be empty and not tagged. So if you look, sometimes it doesn't make sense to have a tag. For example, on this equity statement, if you have net income, net income is not expected to affect common stock or additional paid in capital. So in that case, one tag is zero or nil because it's just not applicable. Your net income is going to affect your retained earnings and then your total equity balance. So just keep in mind that, you know, even though you're presenting tables and it might have a dash or it's just blank, those aren't necessarily zero. A lot of times they are or they could be, but there are other times where it's just not applicable and it would be inappropriate to tag these amounts as zero because it just doesn't make sense from an accounting perspective. The next area that I'm going to be hitting is calculations. Now, an important aspect around calculations is, and the SEC has brought this up, a number of times, that, calculations is when, you have, a parent and you have two children that may, add up into it. So for XBRL, there are certain calculations, what we call anomalies, or, calculations that don't work in XBRL. So when you have a roll forward, where you have an instant, and then you may have a duration, you are not able to have a calculation that will work effectively with an instant and duration tags. It's just not possible. Also, you aren't able to actually have calculations across members. I mentioned, meaning if you have a member on one tag and you have a different member on the other and they sum to a total, you wouldn't be able to sum across, for example, your statement of equity. You wouldn't be able to sum that across in an XBRL calculation because it's just not possible. There's an anomaly there with XBRL, so you wouldn't be required or able to do that. And then also, calculations really just sum, amounts that sum up. So you wouldn't be able to get amounts, net income divided by weighted average basic shares to get a earnings per share calculation. Calculations do not work that way as well. As I mentioned, our manual has a section 615.2 that requires calculation relationships when they're expressed in the filing. The SEC doesn't automatically violate this rule, but I do want to point out that this has been one area where the SEC has sent out Dear CFO letters to certain companies that were missing calculations around their XBRL. So it is an important aspect. To the filing, and the SEC is clearly focused on this. So you want to make sure that any summations that are possible to be an XBRL or required, that you have those calculations in those circumstances. This is just an example in order to get your calculation weight. So there is something called a weight where if your parent's tag or the amount that the children or something to has a debit balance, there's something called a weight that you have to put along with the children. So if your parent is a debit and your child is a debit, that weight would be positive 1. If your parent is a debit and your child is a credit, it would be entered as negative 1. And then same thing for the, if the parent's a credit, -1 for debit and +1 for credit. So, it sounds pretty simple, but when you get into it, it can get a little complex. So you want to make sure that you're not changing your weights because maybe your amounts were entering in incorrectly as a negative and trying to make the calculations work. First, you want to make sure that your amounts are entered in, correctly, and then you also want to make sure that you're following the guidance for having the correct calculation weight. So two different things, entering as a negative, and then, making sure that your calculation weights are accurate as well. This is an example of an inappropriate calculation component. So when you're reviewing your calculations, calculations need to make sense too. So if you see on the left, this is an example of an inappropriate calculation where you have current assets as the parent, and then you have a calculation relationship with prepaid expense current and non-current. So as you see, current and non-current should not add up into assets current for obvious reasons that assets current does not contain non-current amounts. So, that's something that, once again, sounds pretty simple, But if you're using the wrong tag and then putting it into the calculation, you're going to end up with something like this, and you want to avoid doing that. And obviously, here's an example to the right that would be appropriate is, you know, if your assets current and then your prepaid expenses current, that would that add into it. And then since they're both debits, you would have a weight of positive one because it's a debit to debit. Here's something that we also want to mention, you know, to caution as well when it comes to calculations. Sometimes you're disclosing information and everything, you're not including all the amounts, so it's not footing perfectly. That doesn't mean that you should resolve this calculation inconsistency that would pop up. It's a warning that you'll get in your in a lot of validation software by inserting the amounts to make them foot. So here you have 1.28, you have 0.01. Those don't sum to 1.3, but they do have a relationship between them. Don't change the digit to 0.2 or add another row for something that doesn't exist so that you can make it sum to 1.3. That would not be correct since you're not including that in your disclosure on your source financial statements. Another example where you might be disclosing certain fiscal years, and then for other years, you do not disclose amounts. And therefore, you end up with calculation inconsistency. Once again, calculation inconsistencies are warnings and sometimes cannot be prevented. Therefore, you shouldn't resolve these by inserting values that don't exist in your source financial statements, since you're only permitted to tag information that's included in your source financial statements. So just once again, you will sometimes get inconsistencies because you're not disclosing all the information that would add up, but that's fine. You're just going to get that warning, say, you know, I understand, I'm going to get this, and there's nothing I can do about it. It's you know, permitted. Another area that that we see common issues with is people putting in, you know, date contexts or the specific dates that go with each tag. So this is kind of a good slide that I use to give you when you're determining, you know, when to use date, what to use for dates, and then sometimes you need numbers, you know, to identify situations. So if you have an amount that relates to the reporting period, then your amount should relate to that specific reporting period, you know, that you're disclosing. If you actually have an amount that relates to a period after your reporting period, but before you file, you should use a subsequent event member and then have the date after the filing. So it should match your financial statements of when it happened, but then you should always have a subsequent event member. If you don't, there's going to be an issue with that. And then afterwards, if you're disclosing a number that after you're actually filing your information, it's in the future, any future amount would have to have a forecast number and then that date in the future for that. So if you're ever in question, you know, we're disclosing this amount and it's actually after, you know, we're filing, if you would use that future date, but you should always have a forecast because it's not a final number. Another important area is deprecated concepts. So, you know, listening to the FASB when talking about, you know, new taxonomies, there's something called deprecated concepts, and those are because there's either changes in accounting standards, they're removing duplicate tags that exist, so they only want to have one tag that exists. Maybe removing the tag because it had an erroneous element or had an error in it, or creating new concepts to replace the deprecated item with key corrections. So when you have a deprecated concept that was a tag in a previous taxonomy that's now deprecated, you are not permitted to use that tag in the current taxonomy. So that's something to really make sure that you're not doing because that would cause a major issue from that. So just check your errors and make sure that you're not using deprecated tags. Another area that I see commonly sometimes is you might have related values. So you have your cash inflows or outflows related to a transaction, and then you also have the actual income statement effect, the expense or revenue aspect of that information. There are specific tags on cash flow that should never be used for revenues or, expenses or revenues, and there's tags on the revenues that shouldn't be used in a cash flow statement. So if you have specific tags that are specific to inflows or outflows or proceeds from, you only want to use those in the cash flow statement. You don't want to intermix those between the different filings. Make sure you're very careful because we do see a lot of that sometimes. Other area is decimals. So decimals represent what the rounding is in your financial statements, for the amount. So, what we have is expected decimals and then below unexpected. So if you have an actual amount, if it's exact, you use something decimal of INF. If it's to the 2 decimal places to the nearest, penny, you would use a positive 2. And thousands of -3 and millions -6. So you'd never expect to have a very precise number and then a higher decimal unit when it's rounded to. It just doesn't make sense. And we tend to see either companies not putting INF for exact amounts or saying, well, everything for financial statements is in thousands. Well, you might disclose a few numbers that are like 1.3 million. That's actually to the nearest 100,000, so you wouldn't want to use in thousands for that number. So just be careful when you're focusing on the decimal attribute to make sure it's accurate. The next area is, having the correct unit type. And so there's something called the unit type registry. And this makes it pretty easy. They're standardized units, and it actually matches the tag type with the unit type. So you probably, it's hard to see this, but if you go to the registry, online, you'd be able to see this. And when you're determining units, you have to file this unit registry, or you're actually going to have an error. So if there's a unit on the UTR that's standard, you have to use that standard unit. If not, you're violating the rule. Next slide. These are just some rules related to it. So if the data type is shown on the unit registry, you're only allowed to use the units associated with the data type, for that. The filer should not create units for units that already exist in the registry. You can, however, create units for amounts for types that don't exist in the unit registry, and you should as necessary. Moving on. This is kind of a good slide that you can use. It kind of breaks out type to unit. So, using this, and I'm not going to go through each one, it kind of helps you make the decision, okay, what's my tag type and then what should the unit be, breaking out. And just to point out one area that I tend to find sometimes as well is there's a difference between a pure item type and a percent item type. So a pure item type would be used when you have a ratio in which the numerator and denominator are actually different. So dollars per, barrel of oil, let's say, or dollars per child. And then percent is a ratio in which the numerator and denominator are actually the same. So if you have a ratio in which you have US dollars over US dollars, you should use a percent type, not a pure type.
Jared, I think I'm taking over from here.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you, Michelle.
Okay. Jared, thanks so much. That was great. Read the slides. We do have a couple of questions for Jared. The question is, have you ever seen the type of error where there is a non-numeric element that has a label that should be used, let's see, a non-numeric element, but it has a label that should be for numeric values? Jared, have you ever seen an error like that?
Well, I think what you should definitely pay attention to is if the label looks like it's if it looks like a numeric label, but it's actually not meant to be used for numeric amounts, then you shouldn't use it. So just make sure if you're using whatever you're tagging, the Eggert Filer Manual says make sure that the tag type, the period type, and definition are accurate. So if your tag type is meant for, and it would have like if it's dollars, it'd be monetary. So if it's got the wrong tag type from what you expect it to be, you shouldn't be using that tag. So just don't pay attention to a label. Make sure you're paying attention to the attributes of the tag. I think maybe that's, hopefully I hit that question.
Okay, and one more question, Jared. And this relates to sub-event members. When you still use a sub-event member, even if you were using a date after the period end?
So I would think that, I guess I'm not sure. It depends on what you're disclosing. Usually, subsequent event amounts are on values that are known, which you would have to, it would have to be before you filed. So I'd say if you think if that's part of a subsequent event, then you should use a subsequent event member. With that being said, if it's after the filing, you should definitely have a forecast member, I would say, because it wouldn't be possible to know what that value is before it actually happened. You can estimate what you expect it to be, but it's not, you know, an actual until it occurs.
We're going to go on and talk a little bit about automated versus manual validation methods. There are different kinds of validations, and they fall into two categories, automated and manual review and checking. Automated checks, which are rules that are available to cover certain circumstances, that they can be invaluable because they can be applied consistently and cost-effectively throughout a company's external business document. The forms of automated validation that are available, they essentially look inside the XRL filing at the individual facts reported. They consider the values themselves. Are these values inside an appropriate range? They look at the metadata associated with that fact. Is the scale correct? Are the units appropriate? Is the appropriate distillation weight used? You can also check the tags that were chosen and the combination of tags that were chosen through automated rules. And finally, automated validation looks at the accuracy of exceptional relationships. But manual review must also be performed. Manual review considers if the XRL facts match the reported HTML. It looks for completeness. Is everything included that was on the HTML? It looks at accuracy. Are the facts reported correctly? Manual review is also needed to determine if the correct concepts were used to tag the facts reported. To some extent, automated validation can help, but internal company knowledge is needed to determine the concepts of the right definition for a fact that a company needs to report. We're going to talk more specifically about these forms of automated validation. And we're going to talk about XRL specification validation, SEC Eggert Filer Manual validation, and we'll finally talk about US taxonomy validation. So first, let's talk about specification validation. The XRL technical specification must be run and must pass successfully in order for the file to be accepted to the SEC's Eggert system. This form of validation checks that the most current technical spec is being applied. Most tools on the market today that you typically use will include this as part of their package. The second kind of validation is Eggert filing validation, also known as SEC validation. This reviews the filing and it checks the automatable sections in the Eggert filer manual. It specifically looks for syntactical rules that have to be followed. And here again, the instance document must pass SEC validation before it can be accepted into Eggert. The third form of validation is what we're calling US GAAP validation. And these are rules related to consistency in the use of the US taxonomy. They are available in automated form, and they're going to review the actual document to determine how well the document adheres to the definition and structure of the US GAAP taxonomy. What you're looking at here is a portion of a validation report for a company that had a negative input error. So this is obviously one of the more common kinds of problems and occurs when the value should be positive, it should be positive, it's entered as a negative, as Jared was explaining. US GAAP validation can cover a lot of different types of error types. And here you see 30 different error types that it covers. The most common type of problem are invalid access member combinations. And that comprises about 31% of all of the errors that we see fall into this category of problem. The second most common error are negative value checks. And about 14% of the errors that we've seen, are negative value input errors. Other common kinds of errors are required values that are not reported, things like assets or per share, which the company neglects to report or differently extends. Incorrect dates, you heard Jared talking about this as well. So there are lots of different areas where companies can make mistakes in their filing, and these kinds of mistakes will ultimately result in inaccurate data. While validating your extra filing, make sure to use both. Use both automated techniques as well as manual techniques. Automated ones will, be very consistent, be easy to apply, and will help alert you to some of those problem situations. But manual is also important to make sure that you check on things like accuracy and completeness. Make sure that when you run the validation, you do it on the instance document and on the extension taxonomy. And as we always say, validate early and often throughout the creation process to make sure that you check on those issues and catch them before you submit them to the SEC. Now, before we move on to the next section, which will be on the FASB implementation guides, we're going to do another poll question. So if we could bring up the poll question here. Okay, the question pertains to SEC validation. SEC validation checks an XREL instance document for which of the following? It checks to ensure that the proper XREL specification is being used. It checks that the automated rules in the SEC's XREL filer manual are being followed. Or third, it checks the issuer has entered fact values correctly. Which of these is correct? And again, you have about 60 seconds to respond to this. Okay, great. Okay, now we're going to go back to our presentation, and I'm going to turn it over to Donna Johanneman from the FASB. Donna?
Thanks, Michelle. Before I get into talking about the guides, I just have a disclaimer to read. The views expressed in this presentation are that of the presenter. Official positions of the FASB only after extensive due process and deliberations. So with that, we'll get into some of the guides that we have. We started publishing these guides in 2013 to try to help provide some additional information around how we intended the elements to be used. We found that there may not always be enough information contained within the taxonomy itself for people who are not using it every day to understand what we were thinking when we created these elements. The guides that we've been issuing are selected topic areas for significant accounting standard updates and for reference guides. The topic areas have come up from public comments submitted or questions to the XREL US's Best Practice Committee, one we've internally identified, and other constituent feedback. The accounting standard updates, the significance may not always just be in the form of a substantial accounting change, as in the case of revenue that recently came out this year, but also maybe because of the impact of the taxonomy or complexity in modeling that it may involve. It may have multiple dimensions around it, so we may create those because of those reasons, not just for the number of elements. The reference guides were generally developed for the taxonomy team here to use as we were making changes to try to establish a framework to ensure consistency. Now, some of the guides that we have on the selected topic areas that are either out or in process are here listed are intended to keep the versions aligned with the taxonomies that are available, which is what the years here are representing. So if you listen to our September webcast, you may know that we are working on two targeted topic areas currently, which are pensions and fair value. We're receiving feedback from our taxonomy advisory group, industry resource groups, and Actuarial US as we work through these topics. We expect to have a guide published along with changes to the taxonomy. These changes will likely not be in the taxonomy until the 2016 version, but we hope to publish them early next year so we have a lot of time for feedback. The guides are helpful in understanding how we intended the elements to be used. It may not always be so apparent, as we said, looking at the taxonomy. In the past, we would sometimes try to adjust the definitions to clarify the elements, but we realized that that was not always enough. The examples that we provide in the guides help identify whether the area was structured using only line item elements or a combination of dimensions or axes with the line items. The examples are based on disclosures we found in filings and or sometimes from illustrations in the codification, particularly on the new accounting standard updates. Even though there may be some that are more industry-specific, as noted, you'll see there's a couple insurance guides here, there may be broader applicability even contained within those. In a sense, the concentrations of different types of risks are disclosed across industries, even though the risk in that particular guide may be specific to the insurance industry. The structure for other risks would be similar and can be used to help understand the intended use of those elements to convey that information about concentration of risk. Some of the guides that we have around the more significant accounting standard updates are listed here on the slide, and we found that these tend to be more frequently downloaded even than the topical guides, which is probably not too surprising as these can be very helpful in tagging new required disclosures. There may not be filings out there that have the disclosures in them for you to compare with your peers, so the guides can help for that initial setup. I expect at some point in the future the new guides will be coming more from the accounting standard updates, but hopefully we'll have the other topic areas already covered. We have a bit to go before that happens, though. As we prepare samples and instance documents for our own use, when we're looking at these topics and trying to structure the changes to the taxonomy, it just made sense for us to make them available to help filers understand how we are intending the elements to be used, particularly with these new disclosures. The last set of guides that we have are the reference guides that I mentioned before. Currently, we have the definition and period type selection guide out available on the website. We're working on a balance type guide, which is in progress, and a lot of that is coming out of our work with our pension targeted topic that we've been doing. There are a number of required disclosures in that area. We've rolled forward, and people were struggling with the inconsistencies in the balance types between those rolled forwards and other areas of the taxonomy. And one of the themes we consistently hear about, both from preparers and consumers of the data, is consistency. It's hard to understand how to tag it properly when it is not the same within an area or between areas. So these guides are intended to help our team have a consistent approach going forward, and as we target topics, we can make them consistent within those topics. However, we also felt that it was useful to publish, one, if people wanted to understand why we model things the way we do, and secondly, if filers needed to extend an element, it would help them create it consistent with the taxonomy, which would help consumers with the data. And with that, I will turn it back over to Michelle or Amy to go through the next section. Thank you.
Donna, thanks very much. We have, before we move on to Amy Beers from the ASCPA, we have one last survey question. So if we could bring up the survey question. The question is, which of the topics below has the FASB not created an implementation guide to cover? Segments, business combinations, or pensions? Now I'm going to turn it over to Amy Beers from the ASCPA. Amy?
Thank you, Michelle. Today I'm going to talk about the U.S. GAAP certificate program. And the AICPA has partnered with Experience in the West to create a comprehensive training program that is online and on demand. But before I talk about that program and provide a demonstration today, I'd like to ask Jared and Donna a couple questions because they have participated in the program in different ways. So first, Donna, what role has the FASB played in helping develop content for the program? And do you think that there's a need for certificate training in this area?
The taxonomy team here reviewed the modules that were prepared, and we provided feedback to AICPA and XBRL US. Our team here is divided by topics, and we have members that are responsible for their own topical areas. So the modules that related to that topic area was reviewed by those members, team members, as they were the most knowledgeable of that section of the taxonomy. And in terms of a need, I know when I was to prepare, one of my main concerns was where do I go to find out how to do this? The SBIR filing manual has the rules, but I wanted something to show me how. And I wish I had something like this available to go back to back at that time. And we also, when we look for candidates for our team here at FASB, we view that having completed this program as a plus. I mean, you can see on our website currently we have an opening on our team, and you'll see that listed. The certificate program as a a benefit for a candidate to have coming onto our team.
Thank you, Donna. Jared, I know you actually participated in the program. You actually took the program and earned your certificate. And I know you have a lot of experience with XBRL, but why did you decide to take the US GAAP certificate program?
I took it for a number of reasons. First I thought, I want to make sure, it was a great foundation for XBRL. So I've been involved with XBRL for a while, but I just wanted to validate what I knew, and then also validate if there's some additional things that they didn't take in consideration from a risk perspective to make sure that, I had a clear understanding and I was focusing on those particular areas. It's also, hits on, not only just the basics, but then it starts to get into some of the more complex areas when modeling different notes. A lot of my clients struggle, not necessarily on the face when you're just selecting tags, but when you have to model certain notes and then you're getting into, do I have to use one member, two member, three members, no members, what should I do? It kind of presents you a good foundation of, here's how each note was modeled in the taxonomy, and this is how you would present your financial statements when you're tagging. Another area that I thought was great was the fact that, you know, obviously you have your certificate. So I, since I work in XBRL, majority of my career right now in XBRL, you know, it kind of helps my clients, you know, just want to know I am certified in this area. I had one in taking these courses and have a good knowledge and background for that.
Great. Well, thank you. I appreciate that information. It's very helpful. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the program and going on to the next slide now. And some of the things that Jared brought up actually resonated with a lot of our members. And prior to developing this program, we actually surveyed both AICPA and XBRL US members to get a sense of what they were looking for in terms of training. And most had expressed that they needed expert knowledge in the subject area of XBRL. And some of the things that they noted throughout the survey was that they wanted to obtain the knowledge quickly and efficiently. They wanted the ability to demonstrate that they had knowledge externally. They needed in-depth training that could be provided at their own pace and time frame. They don't always have the time to attend training either, you know, outside or go to classes, so they wanted to be able to have online capability. And hands-on exercises were important to help them understand the implementation of the knowledge they would gain. And so we built this program to really address all of these needs. The program, from what you can expect, is about 40 hours. It's online, so you can have access to it now on the web. It's an in-depth program that helps certificate holders build XBRL financial statements for submission to the SEC. They're focused on the U.S. GAAP, and it's a comprehensive review of all U.S. GAAP reporting. And once you've completed all the modules, you will earn a certificate of educational achievement in XBRL. An actual certificate will be printed and mailed to you. So a little bit about the content of the program. Each module is about 50 minutes in length, and there's five modules. It's structured kind of section. The first section is really the fundamental section, which gives you background about XBRL, introduction to the U.S. GAAP taxonomy, introduction to the SEC rules. So it kind of gives you that fundamental understanding of what you need to do to tag your financials. And then it goes into the detail of tagging the financial statements. We've got three separate modules covering the statements themselves, and then 22 modules which cover detailed tagging of footnotes. Now, certain of those detailed footnote tagging modules are actually required to earn your certificate, and if you purchase the certificate program, you'll get not additional optional modules that still provide CPE but are not required to earn your certificate. And as you go through each of these modules, as I said, they're about an hour in length. You will be earning CPE as you go. And we've got, in some of the tagging modules, we've got simulation exercises that have been sponsored by some of the software vendors, and they've allowed us to use their tools in an interactive video application that shows you how to tag the examples in the footnote modules that you've just learned. And I'll kind of take you through a little bit about what that looks like today. Here's some samples of some of the modules that I discussed. A full list of all the modules that are available in the program is actually listed on our website. So if you go to cpa2biz.com and you go to the certificate, U.S. GAAP certificate program, you can listing of all of the modules, and if you click on the modules, you actually will see the objectives of each module and some of the information that would be covered in each module. So as I mentioned, you will earn a certificate of educational achievement, and this is actually a example of the document that you will receive. Today, as a participant in the webcast, you will get a 10% discount if you register for the program when you go to our site, cpa2biz.com. If you enter code UUX, you will discount. We also have group discounts available if you have three or more people that you're going to be registering with. And if you're interested in that, you can contact Jackie Robertson at the AICPA, and her email is jrobertson@aicpa.org. And I think that Michelle sent out this code in the email with the replay when she sent out that information tomorrow. I am going to take you through a demonstration of the program. So, Michelle, will you flip? Okay, great. Thank you. So when you log into the program, when you purchase the program, you will have access to all of the modules in your account. And this is just over the web. You'll have a username and a password, and all of your modules will be list credit hours associated with each of the modules.